nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
And today in Lecture 9, we're going to talk about the challenges of proper drug dosing with nano-delivery systems. And I'm going to start out by discussing how people figure drug dosing with conventional drugs and then talk about some of the differences between nano devices and traditional drug delivery in pharmacokinetics. I'm going to talk a little bit about the problems of scaling up doses from animal systems and how people actually based doses on the basis of your body size as measured by a mysterious area calculation and sometimes the weight of the recipient. However, we're going to learn very quickly that those are pretty gross approximations. And in fact, not only are you all genetically different and different body weights and sizes, but we also have the case of very quickly learn that children are not just small adults. So we're going to see what the ramifications of that are when you start doing that, and so I'll make a number of comments about that. Talk about pharmacokinetics, traditional ways that people have used, and talk a little bit about some of the new ways that people are actually trying to calculate out the pharmacokinetics using compartment models. Various assumptions about conventional dosing, assuming that the drug goes everywhere, in a diffusive model, as opposed to targeted delivery, where things are quite different. We'll also talk a little bit about the extrapolation of animal data to human, because we now have not only a difference in body weights and areas, but in fact very different organs and metabolism, so that some animals are good models for drug dosing in humans and many are not. We'll talk about genetic responses to drug dosing, and how we're obviously humans are not all genetically or genomically equivalent, but we're starting to use various SNP chips and other human genome sequencing subsets to be able to try to predict a drug dose. And then we'll be talking about how we'll use individual genomics to go even further than that. When we talk about dosing in the era of directed therapies, we'll extrapolate what we've learned from directed antibody therapies, which is the current state of the art, particularly in cancer, anti-cancer therapies. And we'll talk about how a lot of these therapies and involving the immune system, as many of them do, are highly nonlinear processes and what some of the dangers are of that, and how a nanomedical approach, we try to avoid some of those unpredictable nonlinearities. And then lastly, I'll finish up by talking a little bit about other ways to external to the body, control the drug delivery inside the body. And I'll talk about two different studies that I've given you also the papers of. One is magnetically actuated release of drugs from nanoparticles in the body. That has some intriguing possibilities. And I've got a fairly recent paper that I think you'll find very interesting on that. And then also light-triggered delivery of drugs. And that may not seem to be a very useful approach, but particularly for nanotherapies involving treatments in the human eye, where you readily can get light back to the rear of the eye, the retinal regions and optic nerve regions and so on. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So today we'll discuss many of these challenges, and I will go through some of these one by one. particularly problems of scaling up doses from animal systems. There tended to be in the beginning, people did a lot of studies on mice and simply did a scale up based on the weight and perceived sort of surface area of organs such that drugs could go across those surface areas, and tried to scale up on those to predict what it would be in a human. So as you know, many studies are initially done on very small animals, and then an attempt to predict what a human dose might look like. But there's vast differences between there, and so we're going to need to look at that in much more detail. And so what I want to do is go through a few of the techniques that people use to both in terms of figuring out the scaling. I'll show you some differences between different animal models and how some of them, and it's not always the same animal model for all drugs, interestingly. You would think that, for example, monkeys would be the best predictor, but sometimes they're not. And sometimes dogs are better than monkeys as predicting. It depends on the drug and the particular target of the drug and the metabolic processing. We also going to talk a little bit about some of the differences in children besides just weight and size, that there actually are, in addition to the adolescent hormonal differences, there are actually much earlier differences in terms of their actual percentage of water weight, if you will, which is much, much higher in young children than it is in adults. And so when you have water-soluble drugs, that can make a huge difference in terms of the actual delivered drug dose. Also, the ability of people to process drugs is quite different. So the metabolism and excretion and breakdown can be quite different from person to person. And so let's go a little bit more deeply into this. If we talk about drug clearance in humans, I'm going to also show you some differences here between five different species, mouse, rat, dog, monkey, and human. And for some particular drugs, they can fall on a very similar line. And so if you take a particular drug that is metabolized in a similar way, then they can look very much the same in terms of the concentration, and then essentially this is a log distribution looking down as a function of time on the x-axis. And then you start seeing sometimes some interesting differences, but by and large, these ones would convince you that the metabolism just is a simple scaling. But I'm going to show you in an upcoming one that the drug clearance and metabolism can be quite a bit more complicated than that. But let's first dispel a little bit of the difference, the idea that children are small adults, which is a very dangerous assumption. And the reason that is really dangerous is largely in this, shown in these graphs, just with a premature baby is over 80% by body weight water, as opposed to if you go all the way over to a older individual, you're down to about 54%. So that's a huge difference in terms of water-soluble drugs. There's also interesting differences, particularly in terms of fat content. A premature infant doesn't have as much body fat yet. Most of the body fat comes in the last few weeks of gestation. You see it jumps, almost doubles and triples going up. First of all, doubles in going from a premature infant to a full term. And then during the first year, again, almost doubles the amount of fat. So that is put on as part of a normal human development. But that also means the water solubility goes down with time. And then it stays remarkably constant through most of life until late in life, when older senior citizens have a shrinkage, if you will, of their body volume, and it's largely through the fluid. There's also a difference in protein, but that is again pretty constant through most of life until you get to about the adolescent years, and then there's a large increase in relatively large increase in protein as the hormones kick in, particularly in boys, but also in girls. So if we think about, here's some, again, some time profiles of a particular drug. This particular drug is an antibiotic against Salmonella. And what this is doing is predicting, taking models of actual data and then predicting it according to various models for a dog, and then seeing how close the models come. And what people have done, is basically taken experimental data and then constructed fairly elaborate models. The initial models that people came up with, which I'll show you in a minute, were pretty simple models because they just didn't have a good ability to calculate nonlinear functions very well and do the fitting and computer modeling of that. So they did basically mostly fits to either single or bi exponential decay curves, and tried to make predictions on those bases. And it's not a bad model, but you can actually see that there are some interesting differences there. The models that were used for a lot of years, some of the most careful studies were done by Diederich, and so Diederich's plots were used for many, many, many years, until they're still used by many people, but to go beyond that required some pretty sophisticated compartment modeling, which was just not available then. So you can see that the Diederich concentration time profiles in humans were basically a series of mostly exponential models and fairly simple differential equations to be able to predict the concentration time profiles of drug going through a human body. And so I've given you the original reference there. You can see it's from 1970. That's sort of the pre-computer age before there was much modeling being done. And now there are much more sophisticated models being used, which I think we can say that the Diederich models gave a good start, much better than what had been used before that time, which was, before that time had been very, very simple models based on just experimental data and looking at the weight and predictions, weight and height, and doing predictions based on size. So this was the state of the art until the last 10 or 15 years, in which case we've gotten more sophisticated modeling. If we go from animal dosing to clinical trial type predictions, the first thing that I think is the most important thing is that we have to pick an appropriate animal model system. And as I mentioned to you, mice and rats are not in general a very good model system. So but they're also they're easier, cheaper to work with. And to work with the more expensive models, which would include dogs, pigs, and monkeys. Now, then your ability and the number of subjects that you can study, the cost goes up pretty markedly. So what you'll see is that there aren't a lot of studies until they're very late stage in those kinds of animal systems. But even then, organ by organ, there are interesting differences. So you actually have to think, is a particular animal system a good model for the equivalent human? And to give you an example, you're going to be having a guest lecture coming up in the next few weeks from Dr. Debbie Knapp in the veterinary school. And what she has developed is a Scottish Terrier bladder cancer model. And it turns out that first of all, that bladder cancer in dogs is remarkably similar to that in humans, to the point where many pathologists can't tell the difference. So it's a good model system. And then she has a model system for Scottish Terriers because they have a much more frequent trouble with bladder cancer. And if you're going to get enough subjects actually coming in, these are owners bringing their dogs in, you have to have a dog which is has a much higher frequency of bladder cancer if you're going to get enough subjects. So she's done that, and that's a remarkably good model for bladder cancer when we try to make test our nanomedical systems. And in fact, that we're working very closely with her to develop anti-bladder cancer drugs, nanomedical systems, that we're going to actually treat the dogs, because that's a much better model than a mouse or a rat, or even a pig for that matter. Pig is a good model for other types of human diseases, but not for bladder cancer. Talk about, does drug dosing really scale? And what do we mean by scale? We have an intuitive sense that a larger person probably needs more drug than a smaller person. But when we think about that, what really is larger about a larger person? The person has a greater weight, and a larger volume that goes sort of according to the weight. But then when you think about the actual drug delivery, the drug delivery goes across membranous surfaces. So hence, that is the reason why people tried developing models for drug dosing based on so-called surface area. So you try to predict what is the surface area of a person. Well, you can't take a person apart and measure all the pieces. So what you try to do is come up with some simple models, and that's why people will actually measure in your doctor's office. That's one of the reasons why they measure your height and your weight, because with those two variables, they can do a calculation. Should you have to have a particular medicine, they can do a calculation of what would be the proper dose for you based on your height and weight, which will give a rough approximation of what your membranous surface area is inside in your body organs. But that said, after all the animal studies are completed, we know because of all of the variabilities from human to human, and the differences even between the case that I cited to you about bladder cancer in dogs and bladder cancer in human, you've got to understand that when you undergo a so-called clinical trial, that you are the next guinea pig. You are the human guinea pig, because we really don't know what it's going to do for you. We've talked about this throughout the course, that most of medicine is making a statistical prediction based on the human population. This is that argument that I gave you that, oh, by the way, 80% of the time this drug may help you, 19% of the time it may not be effective, and oh, by the way, 1% you may have some very bad side reactions, including death. And so what matters to you is not what the statistics are, but what is it for you personally? And nothing else really counts. You want to know where you stand on that scale. So if we look at some Diedrich plots, I just wanted to show you for different drugs here. So these are plots of different drugs where we have taken again our mouse, rat, dog, monkey, and human models and looked at the concentration in the body versus time. And what you see is that there are interesting differences by drug. So it's not only the similarities between the animals, but the metabolism, the ability to process a very specific drug. So you have to test every specific drug one by one and know what the kinetics are. So here we can see that sometimes human and monkey are very similar. Sometimes there's some very interesting divergences of those two. Sometimes human and dog are similar. And in some cases, we see that even human and mouse or rat track pretty well together. So you just don't know that. And these are our whole animal studies that, again, all of this, these studies are very expensive. For that reason, pharmaceutical industry has developed a number of in vitro tests rather than testing. If we know that some of the organs of the animal are more sensitive than others, then we can have basically cultured cell models of those cell types. Now, when they first did those studies, they typically took, for example, liver cells, because liver is your detoxifying organ in your body that virtually any drug you put in to your body is going to eventually be processed by your liver. So liver toxicity was almost always tested. And the problem with that approach was that they got very good at predicting bad liver toxicity drugs and getting an idea of what the tolerable doses would be, because the liver has the ability to detoxify up to a certain point, a certain drug concentration, and then you can overwhelm and start to basically kill major parts of the liver tissue. Now, some of that may regenerate and some of it may not. It's one of the few organs in the body that has some regenerative potential. But that said, they never tested a lot of other organs, and they were so concentrated on that organ that they actually missed what is now considered to be the largest secondary organ being affected, both in animals and now we measure in tissue culture, is myocardial cells, basically heart function. One of the biggest problems we have with predicting the maximum tolerable doses and toxicity is not the liver, but rather the heart, because we start getting heart arrhythmia, palpitations, and other things which can be quite dangerous. And so now the myocardial is now the secondary organ, and before they even get into animal studies, they will test this with myocardial cells in tissue culture and actually do a lot of these dose toxicity. And if you're careful, you can even look at rhythms, because you can actually grow myocardial cells in tissue culture and actually have what looks like a beating heart, actually with the cells actually going in a beating motion, and you can actually measure the changes in the beating rhythm in a myocardial cell culture. So what I'm trying to show you here is that if you look at these graphs, you quickly convince yourself that there is no, you can't say, gee, I would assume that humans and monkeys would always be the closest, but sometimes they're not. So it's very hard to use an animal model with all of these differences. And here we have a monkey that's 99% the same genome as us. And yet the responses can be quite different. Okay, so traditional drug dosing methods, and before we got into the era of genomics, people tried to find ways to scale up on the basis of area, and that was a little bit hard to measure. So weight to volume, the weight is pretty easy to measure. Volume, as it turns out, if you use sort of an Archimedes principle in your bathtub, the amount of water you displace, you actually can predict the volume of the human body pretty accurately. And people have also actually put on, now with modern computer methods, they can just image your body in three dimensions and sit there and calculate not only the area, but the volume of your body with computer images. So that actually can be done pretty well. All of that is to give you some idea of how many areas that you're trying to cross, and how much volume that you're going to be effectively diluting a drug out over. Certainly with an intravenous drug, most of you have a blood volume of between 5 and 7 liters of blood. So if we distributed that equally, which by the way is an assumption which is probably not very good, then you could do a scale up and figure out what the concentrations would need to be. Lastly, a lot of this, you can see you're processing fluids through various tissues and organs. That's very, very similar to engineering principles that have been developed for control process engineering. So this is a domain where a lot of this has been invented by chemical engineers to watch the compartment-to-compartment traffic of fluids and figuring out their concentrations and so on. So control theory for drug dosing looks like a very simple model here, but in fact, the dynamics back and forth. Here are a series of differential equations, and they can be very complicated where they can depend on each other, as well as being, they're not, in other words, not independent of one another, but may be co-regulated in some fashion. So you can develop some very, very sophisticated models, and this has been done by many researchers using control theory. Let's talk a little bit about, so human beings are not just volumetric flasks with surface areas. We have a lot of interesting differences. Even if you were the same size and weight as your neighbor, your genetics are different. Therefore, your ability to process drugs may be quite different. Your metabolism may be different. You may have a particular susceptibility to a particular drug, such that you have a medically adverse adverse reaction, including things like anaphylactic shock and death. So, first of all, we know that human beings are very different, and if we're going to take that into account, we have to measure it. Now, we'll get to the individual human genome scan here in a minute, but it turns out that we do know something about these drugs and what the particular pathways, biochemical pathways in the cell are affected. So we can look at the genetics that is keyed to that biochemical pathway. And that allows us to look at a very small gene regions. Rather than looking at the entire genome, we can look at a very small subset of that genome and look very closely. And as part of that, you can develop down to gene sequences, and you can put them on single nucleotide polymorphism SNP chips and actually test those. And those are being done right now, and that's a relatively inexpensive way to look for specifics where you may have a defect which makes you particularly susceptible for a particular drug or predicting drug response. It can also mean we can predict, for example, by gene rearrangements such as the BRCA gene mutation in breast cancer, that certain women are much more susceptible to a metastatic process in breast cancer disease. And then because of that, we are changing the risk factors. You know, normally, if we take a risk factor across a population, then we would not want to do certain procedures above a certain risk level. But if we know the patient has a potentially very deadly disease, that individual, that group of people, in this case, women who have that BRCA gene mutation, are going to be treated much more vigorously because their risk factor is much higher. So we can do that. By that, we can also predict a lot of things, obviously, on family tree responses, but traditionally those have been much simpler genetic trees. We certainly know that certain diseases, for example, are X-linked disorders, so we know there's going to be a difference between male and female offsprings as to whether they're going to be susceptible or relatively not susceptible to a particular disease. So family trees are certainly, that's why the doctor always asks you about your family tree, trying to get an idea of what the probabilities were of your having a particular disease or condition, because that family tree has some predictive value, but there's still a lot of variation because there's still a lot of genetic variation within a family tree. So if we really want to predict, we can start out predicting these down to the level of very particular biochemical pathways with SNP chips. But where we want to go with this is the individual human genome scan. And you notice I put dollar sign and four question marks there. And the reason I put four question marks in there is that NIH has been putting a $1,000 figure in there. And so far, the figure is somewhere between, 20,000 and 50,000. That, which has come down a lot from over 100,000 just about 3 years ago. So it's coming down. The price of a human genome sequencing is coming down very rapidly. But I'm predicting that it'll be between somewhere between 1,000 and 5,000. And again, if that's a very, right now, the biggest problem we have is we can do the genome sequencing for that. But the question is, how valuable is that sequencing for a particular individual? You know, if that sequencing is let's assume that it's a perfectly accurate sequencing, we know only a few percent of human diseases right now in terms of susceptibility, and predicting, you know, prognosticating what treatment is likely to work. However, that's going to grow during your lifetime very rapidly. And so my guess is that we will be doing SNP chips for about another 5 years, and then we'll start seeing the advent of, for a few individuals, a relatively small subset, where we'll have individual human genome scans. Now, they're actually doing this on a few thousand people at this point, because you have to have that much value of N, if you will, statistically, so you can start looking at some of the variations from human to human. So to get enough data and then to be able to go in and zero in and be able to predict more genes. So with a few thousand people, then what they will do is determine at what point it's valuable enough to jump that up to a few tens of thousands of people or hundreds of thousands of people. But my guess is that it's going to take a number of years, probably at least 10 years, before we have enough diseases before it's considered a good idea to sequence the average person and sequence each one of you. Because to have the information but not be able to do anything with it, that's a huge amount of money. Even if you take 300 million people in the United States and you sequence them all at $5,000 a piece, that's a pretty good chunk of money. Particularly if you're not getting a good return on that. But eventually, I would say if you can get this for $5,000, and I think that figure will turn out to be a realistic figure, then I would predict that once you know what to do with that data, that will be a very cost-effective strategy. Because right now, picking the wrong therapy, which happens a lot with cancer patients, they'll pick one drug, they'll give the patient $50,000 worth of drugs, and then say, oh, that strategy is not proving very effective. If they were able to predict that up front, they've now already got a tenfold return on a $5,000 genome sequencing cost. So I think that this, as we develop that, eventually this is going to be part of your common medical record. And I think that's not an unrealistic thing to think. And that you wouldn't want somebody giving you a medicine that somebody didn't have some prediction as to what, how your individual genome and your body is going to respond to that. But that's probably 10 years in the future. But at that point, you wouldn't want to bring your family, you or your family member, to a hospital that didn't provide that. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, we've talked about dosing with simple scale-ups, predicting your, based on your height and weight and surface area, whatever that means for an individual. That is assuming that the drug goes everywhere and that basically what we have is a concentration gradient-driven process of drug delivery. If we get away from that model, and if you want to think about it, the idea of putting a drug inside a nano device is kind of like a quantizing drugs into discrete packages, and also having them circulate longer, having them go highly targeted. It's no longer going by diffusion. It's no longer going by gradient driven. So that changes vastly what the pharmacokinetics are, and changes the dosing equation. It also means that not only, as I said, a good figure that you should think is that a typical nanomedical therapy should be able to get by with tenfold less drug putting into the body and get effectively an equivalent amount of targeting to the diseased. So tenfold less drug as a ballpark figure that you should be thinking about. And then also that it has the ability, since it's targeting, it's not only tenfold less drug to start with, but that it is highly targeted. Yes, you can make some mistakes depending on how good your biomarkers. We've been talking about how you have to have a marker if you're going to do a receptor-mediated uptake. If you're not using a receptor-mediated uptake, if you're taking a drug which is being secreted by a nanoparticle, let's say a larger nanoparticle based, you know, similar to what's been done with liposomes, perhaps with a mesoporous silicon secreting with nanopores, then targeting into the area of a diseased organ and then secreting basically a drug locally with a local concentration. That might be concentration gradient driven, but only locally, not systemically in the body. And that makes a huge difference. We'll talk a little bit about the current generation of directed antibody therapy dosing, and the next generation dosing. Now, the current directed antibody, this is where we have an antibody against a cancer, and I'm going to show you some examples of that. You're still using the antibody as a targeted, if you will, a targeted thing, going for the disease cells of interest, but it's out in the bloodstream, it's exposed, it has the ability to interact with other things. And we're going to discover that one of the biggest problems with that, even though it's targeted, it still has a very high rate of actually being taken up by cells which you did not want to target. And they can be taken up in other mechanisms. We've talked previously about pinocytosis and phagocytosis. It turns out that when you put raw antibodies into the bloodstream, then there are a number of problems with that. And one of them is that your phagocytic cells, your macrophages, your neutrophils will eat those antibodies and will, in general, in many cases, die from uptake of those antibodies. And so you can develop some rather bad side reactions like neutropenia that has to be then treated with another drug, typically a hematopoietic growth factor to produce more neutrophils to replace the ones that are killed off. So what I'm going to do is take you through a little bit of some of the current generation directed antibody, because that's the closest thing that we have right now to actual nanomedicine. And directed antibody therapies have been around since the first one in the United States was approved, was rituximab against non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the year 1997. So we have about 14 years experience with this. There are now dozens of antibodies that have been approved by the FDA in the United States. And we have a large amount of experience now with those. So we know what a directed, you know, an antibody-driven targeting system kind of does with that. And that also gives us some idea that if we could just fix some of the problems that are inherent with a directed antibody therapy and make it more effective, then we would truly be able to make a big advance. Directed antibodies have made a huge advance. So say if you're lucky, if you have a cancer and you're lucky enough to have a cancer for which there's a monoclonal antibody, then that is a huge advantage over having to take chemotherapy. Chemotherapy has such bad negative side effects to your immune system, to your all proliferating cells and your bone marrow and gut, that if you can get around having to use that, then right now many patients that do have those specific types of cancers are no longer even being given chemotherapy. And I might add that is perhaps a little traumatic to the oncologists who have used chemotherapeutic drugs for the last 40 years, but now the new generation of oncologists are realizing that it makes very little sense to, as some oncologists want to do, to give chemotherapy along with the monoclonal antibody therapy. The monoclonal antibody therapy requires an active immune system to interact with it, and your chemotherapy is is reducing the effectiveness of your immune system. So on one hand, you're trying to do something and then you're taking away with the other side of the treatment. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to do that. It's more of a not sure that the antibody is going to work, and therefore I'm going to give them the other treatment, which will kill everything that's proliferating, whether it's a tumor cell or not. So I think I make the argument that I think that should be a pretty much a last ditch effort if the antibody is not effective, rather than a first effort. So most of these directed therapies, these just straight antibodies against, for example, cancer, particular types of cancer, they require interaction with the functioning immune system. They're highly nonlinear, meaning highly nonlinear things are very dangerous because they're hard to control. And again, most of these things, there's no feedback control system. And we have also learned that when we made those antibodies, if you remember the lecture where we talked about the structure, those antibodies are originally made typically in mouse, and then they undergo various rearrangements of the sequences, of the amino acid sequences of those antibody proteins, such that they are humanized or made more similar to a human sequence to avoid a bad reactive shock. And I can tell you that it's not a very reassuring thing when you're given, and I've literally been there on the spot with my wife, where it's quarter till midnight and the doctor says, well, your wife will either start getting better in the next 15 minutes or she'll go into anaphylactic shock and die if we don't save her, meaning a bad immune reaction against those humanized antibodies. So I've been through that experience. It's not a pleasant one. What we'd like to do is not have even humanized antibody sequences floating around in the in the blood and able to interact with the immune system, which may cause a huge response, in this case, anaphylactic shock, which can kill the patient. So what we'd like to do is use the targeting mechanisms of an antibody, but use some of the things that we've learned about stealth layers and protecting from direct immune interactions with it. And we'd like to, in many cases, even if a patient hasn't been given chemotherapy, the patient's immune response may be not very reliable. So what I've tried to do is give you my personal prejudice in developing nanomedical systems that are just independent of the immune system. They don't necessarily interact with it. They don't necessarily, they don't need it. They can act independently of it. And then you really have the best of all worlds. You have whatever partial immunity. Typically a person will get a cancer, for example, because their immune system doesn't very efficiently recognize tumor cells as opposed to normal cells. But there may be some partial recognition. Usually all of cancer therapy is designed to knock down the number of tumor cells so that whatever functioning immune system is there is able to deal with the remaining tumor cells. So reduction of tumor load is always the goal. And so if we can do that, we can keep the immune system, whatever partial help the immune system is able to give, but develop an independent system that doesn't interfere with that. So we want to make, if you will, completely independent systems that don't cross-react with each other, don't depend on each other, because there are, again, cancer patients who have virtually no detectable immune system, and therefore these directed antibody therapies alone would not work. But if we can design a nanomedical system that doesn't need a functioning immune system, then it would be fine. And we also would not have the dangers of anaphylactic shock and other really highly nonlinear swings of the immune system attacking. As we know, there are a number of interesting human diseases, including hemorrhagic virus infections like Ebola virus. The Ebola virus does not kill people. What kills people is a huge overreaction of that patient's immune system. So while it may be counterintuitive, what they do to treat Ebola victims now is they actually use immune suppressants. They actually depress the immune system so the patient's immune system doesn't kill the patient. And the virus, and then the patient will in general survive the viral infection. So a very counterintuitive thing, but something that I think we can learn a lot from. So let's, I'm going to give you some examples, not going through all of these, but just a sort of a laundry list of different types of cancers. As I said, the very first one that was FDA approved was rituximab or Rituxan against non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1997, but there's a growing list. And you'll notice the naming of this. We're going to talk about the naming conventions of this. All of these tend to have a, for example, rituximab, MAB. That MAB is monoclonal antibody. So when you see a drug name that has a MAB on the end of it, chances are, if they follow the convention, that is an antibody therapy. And we're going to learn that there's a small molecule equivalent one to that, which has a different ending on it. So there's a number of these, and in fact, it's not. I'd like to say that the pharmaceutical companies have obeyed the conventions of the World Health Organization, but like most things, they haven't very well. In some cases, there's the beginning part of the name of the drug is left up to the pharmaceutical companies. The target site, and they actually have a code here, letter code, by what the target site of the antibody is, and source of the antibody, so you can see what it was made in. And so if you have an example, rituximab just happens to be one. The RI, for the first two letters, was the unique name. TU was the target, the miscellaneous tumor. XI was the source. It was a chimeric antibody. Remember, chimeric is part mouse, part human, where we've actually ligated together pieces of the antibodies so that we can make something a little less immunogenic. And then MAB being the monoclonal antibody. But you can go and look at these conventions and see. As I said, they don't count on the companies being very good at their following this, but there is supposed to be a system. Let's talk about one of those, for example, rituximab. This particular monoclonal antibody is targeted to treat types of B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and what it does is it actually recognizes a molecule called CD20, which is on the surface of the cells, and unfortunately, I'd like to say that CD20 is just on the tumor cells, but that's not true. It turns out it's also on normal B cells, not the very earliest development as they come out of the stem cell compartment, but sort of the middle segment of developmental pathway, sort of mid-development B cells, all have CD20 on them. So when you take this drug, it not only wipes out the tumor cells, but it also wipes out the normal B cells in that mid-stage of development. It leaves untouched the ends, interestingly. At the lower end, it leaves the early B cells alone because they have not expressed CD20 yet. And then the CD20 expression is lost in late-stage B cells as they become plasma cells to secrete antibodies. So you've got that mid-zone. Now that leads to some very interesting problems. So what do you do with a patient who is on rituximab, destroying its B cells, and then you come to flu season? How do you give a flu shot to a patient who's on rituximab therapy? Well, what you want to do is you want to wait into the sort of after the decay of the drug, and that the compartment is just starting out. And what you do is you actually calculate how many weeks it's going to take to actually develop a plasma cell, and then hopefully give the flu shot, the immunogen, at the time when it can actually develop that, get to the point where it has a cell which is secreting some antibodies. So it becomes a challenging thing, but it actually can work. Rituximab actually binds to the cells. It triggers an immune response, so it brings other immune cells in a very complicated process. So the rituximab antibody goes against the CD20, and then other immune cells recognize that it has identified something foreign, and then they attack the cell. And it can also induce apoptosis, depending if it has some other things with it. Sometimes the rituximab is also used with a radioactive antibody if the patient's has a very high, you know, up to a, not a very high, but a dose of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that is not doing very well by requiring the immune system. So sometimes they'll just tag a radioactive probe onto that antibody. But the problem is that a radioactive probe not only kills the cell, it kills a region around that cell. So if you have more than about a 20% involvement of these B cells in the bone marrow, then what ends up happening is it would effectively, if you had a radioactive antibody, it would destroy the functioning of the bone marrow. So then they would not be able to give it. So they'll actually look and count cells in the bone marrow and say, no, we can't give a radioactive version of this because while we'd like to be able to do that, it would destroy the bone marrow in the process. So we have, this is just one example of that. There are other ones. There are a number of different lymphomas, even different lymphomas and leukemias. So what they look for is particular biomarkers and particular stages of development in a very particular way. And until people had biomarker characterization of lymphomas and leukemias, which we used to say, oh, there's two types of cancer, a lymphoma and a leukemia. Now we know there's over 200 different types of lymphomas and leukemias defined by those biomarkers. And so what they're able to do is come in with exactly, they test it, and they come in with exactly the right antibody that is against that particular type of lymphoma or leukemia, and it'll attack that, you know, much more specifically. So when we look at morphology through a microscope, like a traditional pathologist would have looked at it, with a hematoxylin eosin or H&E stain, we would simply look at the morphology and say, oh, that's a lymphoma cell, that's a leukemia cell. Now we look by multicolor flow cytometry, and this is a standard treatment in every major hospital. They will actually do a flow cytometric immunophenotype of different types of leukemias and lymphomas to know exactly which molecules are on the surface. So they'll actually screen them against panels to determine the type of disease. That also allows them to be very good at prognosticating which treatment's going to work and which isn't. They used to just treat all lymphoma people the same, all leukemia people the same, and that really didn't make much sense. So what they got was a wide, first of all, many people that was completely ineffective treatments, and they didn't know why. Now we do know why. So we're making tremendous progress in that regard. We can also deliver toxic drugs directly. Bexar is the radioactive one. This is typically with iodine-131 given to some patients against the CD20 instead of rituximab. We have other alternatives. And this is, again, different radioisotopes. They've been trying to get more sophisticated with that to not have as much side effect in terms of collateral damage. A second, we've talked about antibodies, but a second major class now, which is if we talk about small drugs, the pharmaceutical industry is very keyed in right now to making small drugs which actually go inside the cell and interfere with signal transduction pathways inside a cell. And the common name that you'll see, signal transduction inhibitors, you'll typically see an IB on the end of that. And you see most of these have that in their name. This is one that, an antibody, so it's not an IB. So there's a whole variety of small drugs, and when you have typically a NIB on the end, then that's saying that it is going in and it's designed to go exquisitely precise down a particular signal transduction pathway and to change the functioning of that signal transduction pathway, either to interfere with it, block it. Most of the time it's an inhibitor, which is a negative feedback is a whole lot safer to use than something which is a positive feedback system. So most of these are negative feedback inhibitors along signal transduction pathways. So there's a number of different ones that I've shown here. And just a laundry list, and you can go through that at your leisure for different types of diseases. Now, some of these small ones have some interesting interactions. They can go in systems that affect, for example, affects growth and proliferation of tumors, so they can actually sort of down-regulate the growth and proliferation. As I said to you, one of the goals we should have, rather than just straight destruction of cells, because remember, the biggest problem we worry about is, are we actually going to have failure of an organ? Which is, you know, people don't die of cancer, they die of organ failure, either by the cancer or the treatment. So what we'd really like to do is to get rid of problems of growth and metastasis, in particular in cancer. So these are a variety of different approaches we can have here. We can also, there's also new types of targeted therapies where we're actually trying to regulate the expression, the gene expression of certain metabolites and products in a cell. And these are really interesting, and as you can imagine, one of the ways that people explore these is to actually use gene expression profile chips, like Affymetrix chips, for example, looking at the RNA, where they can screen along and look at the entire genome and actually look at what's happening in the disease and zero in on the gene expression profile. If they can then figure out that the production, quite often the production or overproduction or underproduction of a particular protein may be the actual visible cause of the disease. In other words, may cause abnormal proliferation or metastasis. And if we can simply downregulate the overexpression of that, particularly of oncogenes, then those cells can effectively be almost perfectly normal. And this would be along with our goal, rather than just destroying by surgery or otherwise large numbers of cells, particularly if you have a large number of cells involved in a particular tissue or organ, and you try to get rid of them, then you're probably going to lead to organ failure. So an approach that people are starting to get into is say, if we can figure out which proteins we need to change to regulate, then we may be able to leave that disease cell in place and just treat it as if you will, as a chronic disease. Now that may seem a little bit unusual, but I think eventually we will treat most of our human diseases like chronic diseases. We'll leave them in place and we'll simply downregulate the bad effects of the gene rearrangements. We typically won't rearrange the genes in the cells. That would be a little bit difficult. But what we can do is modify their expression. There are a number of not only drugs that you would normally think of, but the active ingredients in various vitamins. Retinoic acid is, for example, is a known differentiating agent, and there's been a lot of work done over the last 30 years, so that usually growth and proliferation and differentiation are sort of opposite pathways. And one of the reasons why cancers grow is that they stop differentiating and they just proliferate. And if we can push the cancer cell into a differentiation mode rather than a proliferation mode, then it'll get to a what we call a terminally differentiated cell, and it will stop growing. So this has actually been tried in cancer patients. I actually did a lot of work with the group at the University of Rochester back in the 1980s, and we were able to treat cancer patients with differentiating agents such as retinoic acid, and to actually slow the growth of tumors by having those cells differentiate rather than proliferate. So there's a wide variety of those that modify cell expression and function. And I think really you're going to see more and more of those as we start worrying about treating chronic diseases, not just cancer. Cancer, we're always obsessed with killing the cancer cells. But as I've indicated to you, even that's not necessarily always a good idea. But with many chronic diseases, we can have perhaps even the majority of cells or all of the cells in an organ are now, their gene expression profile is wrong, and leading to a disease state. So what we need to do is modify all of the cells of that organ, so that the gene expression profile brings it back into some kind of a biochemical balance. Okay. We've talked in the past about if we are going to kill cells, the best way to do that is to get those cells to undergo apoptosis, because under those circumstances, we don't get these highly nonlinear, huge responses of the immune system, which sometimes are worse than the actual disease. The cure, from the immune system point of view, the cure might be worse than the disease. And so what many of these drugs have been developed to actually produce apoptosis in the cell. And that has another very important thing. We've talked a lot about drug delivery and getting the right dose to the particular disease cell. Well, the problem is we've mentioned the difficulty in getting a known number, a particular number of nanoparticles containing a particular amount of drug to a particular cell inside the body. That's a very difficult thing to do. And so one of the things that we can do with, if we can trigger, you have a drug which triggers apoptosis, all you have to do is to reach a threshold effect of flipping on the switch, if you will, which tells the cell to go into apoptosis. Then from that point on, it's not the drug that does anything. It's the cell itself knows that it's been told to go into apoptosis. It then does everything else by itself. It powers itself, if you will. It doesn't need any more drug. All it needs to do is to make the critical decision, do I go into apoptosis or don't I? So it's a marvelously effective way to do that, where you simply trigger it. You could potentially do that with a single nanoparticle. You would not, which would be any drug that you could deliver. But that may be perfectly adequate to actually have the cell go through a complex series of steps, shutting itself down, destroying in the process many of those very bad things that would be released if the cell were simply burst open in a necrosis event, which can sometimes happen if the immune system attacks it and it's not degraded properly. So one of these drugs, kind of interesting enough, causes cancer cells to die by interfering with the action of a particular substructure in the cell called a proteasome. And for the engineers among you who are not familiar with this biological term, the proteasome is basically the garbage disposal unit inside the cell. When a cell is degrading things, it will process them and then put them through the proteasome, and then in the process, the proteasome breaks them down into fairly harmless, in some cases reusable, precursor molecules that can be reused. And so one of the things that you can do is you can block the proteasome. The cancer cell might be doing, you're treating it with a drug, and it's taking that nice drug that you're giving it and processing it very quickly through the proteasome and breaking it down so that it protects itself from that drug. So if we can block the proteasome, then the drug will build up in the cancer cell. It can't get rid of it now through its garbage disposal system, and then it will die. So this is a very interesting way to actually prevent the degradation of something that you want to build up in the cell to cause the cell to go into, for example, into apoptosis. So cancer cells can protect themselves partly by using the proteasome to degrade things. Another very important type of drug that we can deliver with a targeted therapy is a type of drug that blocks angiogenesis. Angiogenesis is basically the factors that cause blood vessels to form around a growing tumor. And this is the pioneering work of Judah Folkman. Many years ago, people said, well, could we starve a tumor by depriving it of its blood supply? So it turns out that that drugs which are anti-angiogenesis are very effective in cutting off the nutrients to a tumor. So if the tumor doesn't get those nutrients through an active blood vessel supply, it will shrink and die. And so there are a number of targeted therapies that have been developed to actually go in the area of tumors, and you could do this by secretion through, again, some kind of a mesoporous structure to release anti-angiogenic factors, which then, instead of killing the cell, killing the tumor, what you do is you starve it of its nutrients. And since the tumor is growing faster, it's the major thing which is soaking up and taking the nutrients from its environment. Usually, the surrounding cells are metabolizing at a much, much lower rate. And so, as we saw earlier, for example, with PET scans, that's how you use glucose as a way of determining what is metabolically active, and those are typically tumor cells. Well, those are metabolically active cells are requiring more and more oxygen and nutrients, and therefore they're sending out signals to surrounding blood vessels to grow toward them so that it can deliver more supply. So you'll end up with huge numbers of capillaries growing around tumors in order to feed it. So if you can prevent that those factors from recognizing that they are, should go to the tumor, the so-called anti-angiogenic factors, then you can prevent a blood supply from being grown to that tumor. So there's a number of ones which have been developed on that part. I just wanted to show you some effects on that. So let's talk about, we talked about directed therapies, for example, monoclonal antibody drugs like rituximab. And unfortunately, they still have some side effects. I've told you that these antibody-directed therapies are much better than chemotherapy. Most of them are designed to kill all proliferating cells. Well, the most common proliferating cells in your body are in your bone marrow and the lining of your gut. So if you kill those, if you kill the bone marrow, then you kill the immune system. If you destroy the gut, the inner lining of the gut, then most cancer patients used to starve to death during the process of the disease because they can no longer keep down food and nutrients. So those are very bad side effects. So we've gotten rid of those with directed therapies, but we still have things such as allergic reactions, the most compelling being anaphylactic shock. Some patients simply cannot take monoclonal antibodies. They're too sensitive to it. Their body goes in, their immune system goes into anaphylactic shock. But a lot of patients have hives or itching, and it can be not a very pleasant experience. Many patients have flu-like symptoms. Again, a lot of fatigue, a lot of muscle aches and pains. Again, unpleasant, maybe better than chemotherapy. Low blood counts, typically, as I said, low neutrophil counts. Remember, the neutrophils are designed to protect you, particularly from foreign objects in your blood, like bacteria, so bacterial infections. And also, it will affect the process along with neutrophils. It'll also affect megakaryocytes, so you'll end up with platelet. Platelets are your ability to control bleeding, so you have platelet losses. So that can be very bad. A lot of nausea, diarrhea, skin rashes. So these are common. Still not pleasant. It's a little better than the alternatives. Having your hair fall out, typically, for patients on chemotherapy. That doesn't happen typically with these, but you still have a large number of these other serious problems. So what can we do? If we think about nanomedical systems representing the next stage beyond, we say, let's learn what we've learned. So first of all, the FDA should be pretty satisfied that we can put antibodies into the human body under taking into account these things that we've talked about. And if we can just make the process better. So when I gave an invited talk to the FDA, what I did was I said, first of all, you should think of this as a combo device. It's a drug and a device. Second of all, you should think of it as the next logical step for directed therapies, where we start to take take into account and prevent some of the side effects that we have by doing certain things. The first side effect we have is we can get rid of some of the involvement of the immune system, because the other thing the immune system does is it attacks those antibodies that you put in and takes them out, so that you have to use a much larger dose. It's been estimated that, for example, in a typical rituximab dose, maybe only 5 to 10% of those antibodies survive long enough to do something useful. So you're using, again, 10 times the dose of antibody that you'd like to be able to use. So if we can use stealth layers and hide the treatment from the immune system, we can prevent neutropenia, because, again, those antibodies are out in the open. They get eaten by neutrophils. That causes death of neutrophils. And so we can prevent a large amount of the neutropenia. Right now, any patient that starts to have neutropenia, they will give them GM-CSF, human growth factor, hematopoietic growth factor, that will stimulate the development from the bone marrow of more neutrophils. But I can tell you what the first thing that happens to that patient is: that patient, again, feels nauseated. It feels like somebody hit them hard in the bone. Their bones just ache because they're being pushed so hard to produce neutrophils. It's not a pleasant thing. It's better than the alternative with infection, but it's not a pleasant thing. Again, many patients don't have an adequate immune system to particularly something like normal rituximab therapy. So that they're not as effective as they should be. So we cannot require a functioning immune system. We can just go directly for that and skip that, the involvement of the immune system. Immune system, again, can be highly nonlinear. We can prevent anaphylactic shock. We don't have to worry about that. So we may be able to give virtually all patients this. Right now, there are still a sizable fraction of patients cannot tolerate these directed antibody doses directly as raw antibodies into their body. So we can hopefully reach a larger fraction of those patients by getting rid of the involvement of the immune system. And lastly, we can use the targeting mechanism. And again, if we don't involve the immune system, we know lots of good drugs. We have lots of great drugs that if we can deliver them in smaller, precise doses to the right place, that are highly effective. So if we think about the antibody as not just tagging the cell and then waiting for the immune system to come and interact with it, as in the traditional antibody therapies, but instead actually be a full nanomedical device that has exactly the right drug of interest for that targeted cell, then we can have very good medical devices. We can also there's a wide range of diseases we could deal with that we can deal with that disease in vitro, in the test tube outside the body. For example, ribozymes are very effective therapy as an antiviral drug. So there's a whole host of viral diseases that we could provide nanomedical therapies, except ribozymes only last a few minutes in the blood before they're degraded by blood enzymes. But if we can include those inside a nanomedical device and deliver them, then they can be highly effective. And in fact, in next lecture on Thursday, I'm going to show you some work that we did and published that we actually showed that we could do that, actually deliver a ribozyme. So lastly, I just want to spend a few minutes over here, but I wanted to mention about ways to activate a drug. We talked about the ability to make a smart nanoparticle that you sort of put it into the body, and then it has to adapt to changing conditions, and it has to go through a complex series of steps and no further involvement with that. That's a tough thing to design. So what people have done is a variety of studies where they can use an external trigger. And the first one is, if you have a particle that is susceptible to a magnetic field, such that you can effectively turn the magnetic field on or off and actually activate the nanoparticle, so that it actually does the equivalent of flipping on a switch in the nanoparticle. Now, that sounds pretty fantastic. What I'm going to show you is a pretty simple system that's been done with that. And that can be done in fairly deep body parts so that it doesn't need to be near the skin surface or whatever. You can make magnetic fields that go quite deeply. If you have a light triggering, then you either have to have something close to the skin, or a very common light triggering thing that people are actively working on nanomedical devices, and this is where some of the nanotechnology that I evaluate for the Glaucoma Foundation, where people are making light activatable nanostructures in the eye so that you can actually flash a light at a particular frequency and wavelength and actually cause that to activate the nanoparticles in the eye. So let me just very quickly go through a couple of things here. So here's a particular one. The paper I've given you is by Thomas et al. In 2010. They basically made a molecule. This is a little bit trying to show you a machine that they built here. But this particular molecule, it turns out, is heat sensitive. So if you put this, if you make the structure where you have a combination of a templated silica, so it's a mesoporous structure, but it also has iron oxide particles in it, so it's magnetic, super paramagnetic, and it can respond to an external magnetic field. This particular part of the structure is heat sensitive. And as I've mentioned to you before, one very nice thing we can do with a magnetic field is we can make an alternating current magnetic field. And by doing that, an alternating magnetic field, we can actually cause a vibration of the particles and generate heat. And so what they actually did was they actually made something which was was normally closed effectively. So they made a channel which was closed at the normal body temperature of about 37 degrees centigrade, or 98.6 Fahrenheit. And so it would normally seal up the drug. And then when they were able to use an AC magnetic field, they were able to get it locally. Now, I do say locally, up to about 52 degrees centigrade, that this actually opened up, melted, and then was able to release the drug. Now, 52, if you remember, I earlier told you that if you put cells in an environment of 42 degrees, they'll start to die. That's about the point where cells will go into apoptosis or start to die from hyperthermia. However, we're not talking about putting cells at that temperature. We're talking about a very narrow region around this nanoparticle is 52 degrees. In the larger context of what a cell is a million times larger, the cell temperature change is minimal. So they actually went through a very nice set of experiments on this, showing that what they were able to do was to get cells, kill cells due to release of drug and not due to the heat effects. So various, they call it the cargo release using magnetic actuators, and they can actually have percent release of drug. You see when there's no magnetic field at all, there's no release. If you do a single pulse, you get a certain amount of drug release. If you had repeated pulses, then you can actually control the rate of release over a period of time. This is over a period of roughly 4 hours. And so it's a very nice study, and they've been able to study this using fluorescent dye releases. But here's a case where they actually used a traditional chemotherapeutic drug, doxorubicin, and actually show in this particular case that they're the normal, the cells here, and then with the magnetic field but no particles, and then here where they've actually released the doxorubicin, and you see that this particular one is showing a uptake of the drug and cell killing, basically, in ones only susceptible where they've actually done an AC magnetic field and released it through that very porous molecule at 52 degrees centigrade. But they did not get a killing of cells that wasn't producing heat that was sufficient to damage the cell. So very quickly, the last thing I'm going to just mention to you is a paper by McCoy et al. And this is a molecule that when you interact light at a particular frequency and wavelength, then you actually cause a chemical reaction and produce a different molecule over here. So that what you can actually do with a strobed light effect, I think this is kind of neat. So we have an off-on switch. So here's an on switch. We shut it off. Here's the drug, basically, release that we have. And we can actually step it up in dose. Turn it off and on and off and on and off and on with a blinking light. So this would work very well. They just did this in a model system, but would work very well, as I said, for something like a glaucoma treatment where you're trying to prevent optic nerve damage in glaucoma. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have, and I'll get these references up there hopefully tonight for you. I have not had a chance to put them up on the website yet. Any questions? No obvious questions? Okay. If you have any, you can email me or bring questions to the next class on Thursday. Okay, thanks.